Welcome to Ride On. I'm here with the co-founder and CEO of Rivet, Dong Tran. Dong's been on the podcast before, episode 166, for anyone that wants to check it out. Oliver Bruce interviewed Dong, entitled Rivet, an Electric Motorbike for the Masses. So there's a lot of background we have with Dong, and it's great to check back in with you, though, Dong, because you've made so much progress, I think, since that episode. So welcome to the show.
Ah, thank you. Thanks, James.
Of course. So, Dong, first and foremost, I think, versus the last episode where we talked to you on, is where you're located. So you're here in California. Last time we talked to you, you were looking to move into your production facility and actually get going. Let's start with an update there. How are things going in terms of manufacturing and production?
Yeah, so we moved into an R&D facility down in Orange County. That's where we started initial ramp up production. We actually just signed a lease a week ago for a bigger facility in San Bernardino. That will be announced later this month. That will be where we really wrap up the bigger and the quicker production timeline. We've also signed a lease for Hawaiian Gardens for a retail location where in the future potential customers can come in, see the product.
Amazing. It's like this continued... Well, there's like two counter stories, I feel like, that you would read on the internet. Like one is like, hey, we're not producing anymore in California. You clearly run contrary to that. And then, of course, just in general, the ability to create such an amazing vehicle in Southern California. Like, we were hearing a lot of those stories too, but manufacturing it right here in Southern California is just an incredible story. Let's talk a little bit about it. I know you and Oliver covered it, but... let's talk about the funding and how you're actually able to do this. How did this all come to be?
Yeah, so we received a generous grant from the state of California, the CalCompetes grant for $20 million that helps keep jobs in California, which means we're able to hire here and manufacture right here locally in Southern California. You know, what enabled that for us is really the manufacturing process of the product itself. It starts in simplicity on how we put these bikes together, which allows us to have a robust workforce locally that we can pick from and not have to go to alternative areas. And California has been very supportive of allowing us to do that by providing that grant.
Gotcha. In terms of some of the ways you assemble these vehicles and everything, and I know you specifically have a passion for sort of the way you've built your folding metal technique. Maybe explain a little bit of that for people that might not know exactly what you've been able to kind of pioneer and innovate there as it relates to how you build these bikes.
Sure. Yeah. The Anthem is made to be very simple. It's all folded sheet metal cut from flat sheet metal stock, right from stainless steel sheet metal. How it's put together, there's no welding. There's really no fixturing process. So it enables an Anthem to be put together by a fairly non-highly skilled labor force. It takes one person about an hour and a half to put an Anthem together right now when we're just starting up ramp, right? The goal is to get that down to an hour and then 30 minutes eventually. So you can kind of imagine as we start scaling, how we manufacture and how we design the Anthem is going to really help us scale very quickly in the United States. And more importantly, it's going to help us scale wherever we end up, right? If we manufacture it locally here in California, it'll be quick. If we go to Asia, if we go to Europe, we'll be able to manufacture locally very quickly.
Amazing. And, I was talking to Scott from Land Energy, and he was talking about, of course, where, his previous motorcycle company, they were in India and in China, and now they've reshored and they're producing everything in Cleveland. I think both of you are examples of pioneers where you're ahead of what is clearly a trend, which is reshoring, important manufacturing, reshoring jobs back to America. And we're seeing the Biden administration, we're seeing the government in general really try to support these efforts. Clearly, your grant is sort of ahead of its time, almost in a sense. Why this is also so important, I want to highlight to our community, is we talk a lot about government incentives and trying to get on parity with the car as it relates to government incentives, whether that's like the EV credit that's out there right now at the federal level or even the way roads are constructed for cars. And one thing that's so critical, of course, is that we can show the government that we are creating jobs locally, that we're manufacturing locally, much like a lot of car companies, of course, manufacture locally. And so it's companies like yours, Dongda and Rivet and Land and others that, you know, it allows us to then go show the government that we are, in fact, locally creating these products. And therefore, you know, if you can realize the vision, you know, you should be offering incentives to customers to bring them in. So I just want to point that out. I think it's really critical, of course, what you try to do.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's local manufacturing. It's also showing that micromobility or smaller types of vehicles have a place in America, right? Because that's the biggest mindset to change is really riding two wheels. Right? It's always been looked at as a dangerous thing to do, but I think if we can change that mindset, we can prove that this is a better way to get around overall, right? It's just a smaller footprint. I think we can get the kind of local support that will help make it not only safer, but make more sense overall.
Absolutely. And so on that, like I, you know, the one thing I was always impressed with you was how I remember, you know, the first time I was able to meet you, you wanted me to get on the bike immediately. You didn't really ask if I was a motorcyclist. You didn't really, you know, you wanted me to try it. And, you know, my hesitancy comes from not having a motorcycle license, not really riding a lot of gas motorcycles, but you know, your enthusiasm, your passion kind of got me excited. And, of course the experience on the Rivet is incredible. And one thing I'm open to hear from you about is like, how do you, you know, there's such a small class of people that ride motorcycles, and yet there's such a larger class of people that is most likely very interested in the idea of a motorcycle, not just because of the thrill, but because of the convenience, because of the affordability, because of the practicality of things like parking. How can you, you know, when do you want to cross that chasm in your journey? Clearly, there's plenty of room to roll with just early adopters, people that want to do the transition of their motorcycle from gas to electric. But how much of an additional pie do you think you can eat into to get at, of course, the appeal of a motorcycle to someone that has never ridden one or is too scared to ride one?
This is a great question. So this is what Rivet is actually all about, right? So I grew up in Vietnam where getting around on two wheels is really a commonplace thing. And most of Asia, a lot of Europe, this is pretty normal. In the United States, it's considered recreational motorcycling. And how we're trying to close that gap is, I think personally, and I think Rivet thinks as a company, riding a motorcycle, that the barrier to entry is actually not the two-wheel part. It's actually the skill that's involved in just mechanically operating a motorcycle, right? You got to learn how to clutch, you got to learn how to shift. That's like asking a new driver to have to know how to drive a manual car. We don't have that requirement in the United States, right? You can get your license in an automatic car, not on a motorcycle. You have to learn how to ride these things. And on top of that, you have to actually pay attention to traffic, learn how to ride safely, be aware. All of those things are barriers to entry. Forget the two-wheel part. I think there's plenty of two-wheel riders out there, right? All the new generation being on e-bikes, that's proof that having a motorized two-wheel vehicle is doable and can be mass adopted. Now, there's barriers to getting the kids that are on two-wheel Surans and Super 73s onto a product like the Anthem. It's legislation, right? How do we simplify the process of getting on a bike like ours? It's probably not a full-on motorcycle license, right? Because you don't need to learn it. It's very similar to probably an M2, like a scooter license, an automatic scooter license. Get on Twist and Go, and all you're learning about is awareness and paying attention to your surroundings and how to ride defensively. So I think there's a big pent-up market in the United States, so long as we can work to really change the minds of local governments on how to enable that.
Yeah. So with your first product, the Anthem, like, it's interesting to think that, you know, you mentioned the Surans, the Super 73s, that's, you know, here in California, very big selling electric, quote, electric bikes. In many ways, the Anthem is almost closer to those than a traditional bike is to the Surans, right? Or to the
100%.
Super 73.
Yes.
Yeah. And yet, like, I think that gap seems so much bigger. How much do you try to think about that as, you know, if I go on your website and look at the Anthem specs, of course, I see top speeds. I see the idea that it's highway, freeway safe or friendly. And yet, like most things in micromobility, it's like, well, what are the majority of the trips? The majority of the trips might actually not be on that freeway. They might be around town. How much do you see the use case as taking the Anthem, 45 miles per hour around town versus, you know, having to open it up and go 100 miles on the freeway?
It's probably 90-10. If there was a perfect use case, we're in the United States, so you're bound to run into an area where you have to get on the highway just for a little bit, right? And so even though we optimize for a smaller battery, lighter weight, less range overall, we still wanted the top speed to be able to keep up safely with traffic, right? And as you know, in California, I mean, the speed limit, even though it says 35 or 40, it's pretty rare to be able to keep up with traffic if you're going at that rate, unless you're in the bike lane, right? Because we are a DOT legal, like street legal motorcycle by class, we needed to keep up, be able to at least keep up with traffic and be safe doing it. Now, the optimized range for the Anthem and any product we do will be more for urban commute, right? I don't think we're ever going to get into super high performance. You know, never say never, but that's not our focus. Our focus is for slower speed, lighter weight, more affordable EV transportation. That's where Rivet's mind is, as opposed to high performance, big range, big motorcycle. That's not where we're focused on.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. And so, yeah, in many ways, you're that in between. Which again, it's interesting to me that one of the perceptions we've got to help people understand is a lot of people are closer to the Rivet and what the Anthem is, for instance, and what you might build in the future than say, the traveler on the big motorcycle going across the country or something. And like, you know, a lot of people are just going to say, you know, it's just like that thrill seeking is not for me. But they'll get on an SUV and drive it a long ways. In many ways you're kind of micro big, like you're like a little bit more of like an SUV, you know, for the majority of these trips, where again, I think we've talked a lot with other, motorcycle companies about the idea that, you know, this is in many ways potentially a safer way to do it, because one of the biggest dangers we're seeing on the roads today are on the Strohs, are on the artillery ways, where the e-bikes are getting stuck on roads where maybe it's Sharrow, maybe it's bike lane, but the road's moving at 45 miles per hour. And the most dangerous place you can be is unfortunately on that road with the limitation of 20, 25, 28 miles per hour.
Exactly. I mean, 28 miles an hour is very slow if you're in traffic, right? So what that means is, I think what's happening is people are taking these bikes that was meant to go 28 miles an hour and they're upgrading or doing whatever it takes to go faster. Now, the biggest danger to that is obviously the infrastructure of your motorcycle, right? Or this bike, this motorized e-bike that you're riding was not meant for those kinds of speed. If it's fully optimized, now obviously, you know, some companies overbuild it so you can handle that speed. Whether or not that's legal, that's a gray area, right? But I think we wanted a product out of the gate that can actually handle the speed that it was meant to go, right? Which is 45 to 75 safely, because that's, you know, just from a liability and a conscience standpoint, we want to make sure that our product is safe to people who ride them on the road every day to actually go to and from work, right? So.
And where do you, so like, let's just zoom out a little bit. Like, where do you think this goes? So, you know, you live outside of Los Angeles. I live in Southern California as well. We see the congestion. We see how people use motorcycles to hack around some of the modern challenges of infrastructure, right? It's still a fairly small percentage, but we know there's a bigger percentage of people that would love to do it, right? A lot of the early electric car adoption was for the sticker, right? It was like, oh, I might be able to hack around. It's not about the environment or anything. It's like, this might be able to get me faster from point A to point B. There is a large and growing demand for the idea of moving around more efficiently. There's also just the idea that like the freeways can't really expand, the urban streets really can't expand, and so we're losing space. A vehicle like yours is really potentially advantageous to this world, to this future world. Where do you like, so, and then, you know, I've talked to the past to other CEOs, like, you know, do you see governments starting to put into place things that help you make it safer to ride a motorcycle, make it more advantageous to ride a motorcycle? Or do you like, where do you see that going? Or do you see it becoming harder and harder where insurance goes up, other things go up, and, you know, like it just, all the regulation is a deterrent to riding this. So they'd rather get you in the, you know, 6,000 pound Ford F-150, even though it's only one person inside of it.
Yeah. So where obviously we have hopes, or we're pretty optimistic about the future. That's, we wouldn't be doing this if we weren't, right? And so the hope for us is that, I think it's also a trend that we're seeing, is especially with EVs. I think it was less so with gas powered vehicles, but with EVs, the trend is to try and go smaller for simple physics, right? It's just more efficient to operate. I mean, we're operating about 60 watt per mile, right? That's how efficient our vehicle is to get one person from A to B. Now, California and some states have already done small things for motorcycles that has made it easier on a motorcyclist, like lane splitting for one, right? It seems odd that you can just go in between traffic, but in fact, it makes a lot of sense, right? It's for safety and congestion. And so I know many people in California, the reason they commute on a motorcycle is because they don't have to sit in traffic. That is the number one reason for riding a motorcycle in California. That alone is worth it for many people. Now, if you're talking about cities, there's parking issues, right? There's storage problems with bigger vehicles. Now, you could just get a small scooter in the city, for sure. And that's why we chose not to go to a full-blown, full-size motorcycle, right? Because we want to kind of straddle that. If you live in the city, but you do want to potentially be able to get on the highway or higher speed roads, this would be that vehicle, right? So we don't fall into urban only, but we also don't fall into high speed territory. We're trying to fill the gap. And I think people growing up, you know, the we call them Gen EVs, they're growing up with these products anyway. So the adoption curve for them will be much lower than going from a bicycle to a full-blown gasoline motorcycle, right? You're going from a pretty fast e-bike to a slightly faster e-motorcycle. Same operation, twist and go, you get on, it's the same exact thing. It's just a little faster and a little more robust.
Well, and just on that point, it's safer, right? The, you know, your brakes are meant for that speed. The weight is meant for that speed. The challenge we have with so many people modding e-bikes is like, that e-bike is not meant to go 45 miles per hour, and therefore all of the componentry around it breaks down, which is way more dangerous.
Suspensions can't handle the potholes. Like, there's no lights, and they don't have turn signals. They don't have real headlights that are DOT approved to actually shine in the right direction. They don't have the right mirrors, right? So a lot of these e-bikes, I mean, they're being ridden on, because they don't really fit anywhere, right? They don't fit on the bike lanes because scaring the crap out of people. And they don't fit on the roads because now you can't keep up. Or if you're keeping up, you're going way too fast for what the bike was designed to do. Which, here's the thing. I think people will always do what is best for them, right? And so the fact that we're seeing people mod these things and go on the road with them means only one thing. That's what they actually wanted. Right. It's just there's no product out there to do that for them easily. Now, there's insurance. That's an issue. There's registration. That's an issue. Some people just don't want to deal with that, right? But insurance for a motorcycle is actually very reasonable. That's what a lot of people don't know, right? It's to insure a motorcycle is $20 to $50 a month. Very reasonable. And that's full coverage, right? If you go liability only, which a lot of people do, it's even less than that. And so I think insurance is not a high barrier, even in California. Now, you have licensing requirement. I think that is the one high bar that's going to hurt our market if we can't get governments to really work on that, right? Because you're not riding a full-on motorcycle. This thing is much easier to ride. You just need to learn how to ride it safely. So defensive riding, which everyone should take, doesn't matter if you have a license or not, you should be learning how to ride defensively, right? Because when we have these products that are not licensable, you can't, they're not road legal. People are riding them without insurance or license. I'm probably going to get a lot of flack for this because I'm in a community that, including myself, that we don't want to be licensed. We want to just ride. Like, why can't I ride on a bike? But yeah, I also learned how to ride a motorcycle properly. So I know the importance of riding correctly, because that takes a lot of the dangers away from riding. And so it's education, right? We need to educate the younger crowd, the upcoming crowd, that what, licensed or not, you should learn how to ride properly. If you're on road with other vehicles, right? So,
well, it's funny, we're like having this, you know, this is kind of like a very, very safety oriented sort of like regulatory heavy conversation when you have this like incredibly sexy bike and you made it in this incredibly sexy way. But honestly, this is the type of conversation that I think like is order of magnitude approach to market share, right? Which is like, how do you go from an enthusiast crowd that of course will buy this, no question. It's just, it's so cool. But like, let's talk about mass market. And so that's why, like, I tell all my friends, like, this is what we have to unfortunately talk about. Because, like, you know, no, if you really look at micro's disadvantages, 1, 2, 3 in numbers is like safety. And then you get into a little bit of, like, theft and stuff, which is still just like, but that could be worked out. But it's really a conversation on, like, are we creating a level playing field so that people can do this in a way that's still thrill seeking, but literally you're not going to die because of that. Because if you can, and not that the car assures that you're not going to die, it just makes you feel a little bit better about potentially.
No, exactly. Right? And it makes you feel more in control. It's the same with everything. I mean, an Anthem versus an e-bike, arguably, they're both just as dangerous if you're not doing it right. Right?
Of course.
If you're riding anything past 10 miles an hour without a helmet and without gear, if you fall, it's going to hurt. Right? They're no longer
bikes. Yes, absolutely.
So there's a false sense of security, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So like you're talking about another trend there I wanna talk about, which is convergence on like where your vehicles, what's happening in this movement. I mentioned before we got on here, like, you know, literally Encinitas would in a meeting recently, you know, they're calculating over 350 kids are riding their e-bikes to schools now. That's like literally up like 30x from what kids were doing just a couple of years ago. Right. And so these kids are on these vehicles. Some of these kids are on modded vehicles. They're learning how to ride. And there's been a big call from like folks like Micah Toll at Electric and others. I've been supportive of it to say like, we should find a way to teach kids, how to ride like a motorcycle license. And again, like what you're saying, Don, is like, we don't need to run we don't need to learn the clutch and everything, everything from a gas powered motorcycle, but we should learn counter steering. We should learn defensive driving. We should learn things that we know are critical. And so like in some ways it's like, okay, maybe this license stuff could actually be good because gosh, these kids really should learn this stuff no matter what. They don't need to learn the stuff that's not important anymore. But imagine now we get a much bigger market. What if every kid at 16 didn't have just a car license, but she had a motorcycle license. And part of that was just so you could ride your e-bike and your e-bike that went over, let's say 20 or something. Cause that to me is like, okay, maybe that would really open the market up and create a safer environment. So that's one thing. I think you're a proponent of that. The other thing I'm curious on is like, you know, you talk about lane splitting and, you know, there's so much happening in the broader world of mobility technology, whether it's, you know, X to C technology that allows for the cars to talk to each other, or it's of course autonomous driving or semi-autonomous driving. Like, let's zoom out 20 years. Do you like just maybe today, do you feel better lane splitting when you know it's a Tesla right there that's potentially an autopilot? Or do you feel better lane splitting thinking it's a human driving the car? I'm just curious your personal opinion.
That's an interesting question. I often think about that because I own a Tesla for a while and I know how good their autopilot is. It's good enough to make you comfortable, which to me on a motorcycle, that scares me a little bit when it's not a human that I can look to. However, it also scares me to think of all the distraction that we have currently with human drivers, right? It's every other car I look at in traffic has their heads down on their phone, sometimes for minutes at a time, right? If I'm on a motorcycle, that's where the education comes in, right? And it's a bandage for now. I think it's always going to be more dangerous. There's no doubt about that. If you're on two wheels, it's going to be more dangerous. So it's a bandaid for now, but being a defensive rider is everything. If you're going to be safe, you have to be able to look around, make good judgment calls, right? And I don't think we'll ever get around that, even with autonomous technology. I think it'll help. Some of the stuff that I think a company like Wheel in San Francisco is working on assisting riders, I think could help in terms of how to maneuver the product. But in terms of other vehicles running into you, that's not something that's ever going to go away, right? And the only way we can change that,
I was hoping you'd be different. Yeah, I was hoping you were going to paint me a utopian picture here. Because okay, so you know, I mean, I'm not sure if you've seen, but Tesla, for instance, Tesla publishes its crash data, right? So it publishes autopilot versus non-autopilot, and then versus the traditional or just the standard U.S. car, as an example. They publish that every quarter. And it is fascinating because, you know, at the beginning, it's like, okay, well, there's not that many Teslas out there. Like, whatever, it's, you know, it's maybe a certain type of person, maybe they're a better driver. Yeah. But now, like, you could argue, at least in California, like, it seems like every 10th car on the freeway is a Tesla now, right? And so you start, I'm like getting more curious looking at the quarter over quarter data. And like, it is pretty clear that the autopilot Tesla is one way better than the non-autopilot Tesla, which is still way better than the average car. And so my thought is like, okay, are we getting to this place where actually we are not that far away from cars hitting, you know, smaller vehicles? And of course, like, you know, we've got Qualcomm here in California. They're working on all these drivetrains that have the X2C technology in it. Like, how far are we away from my Anthem having that in it? And, you know, I'm talking to this car.
As long as everyone is on the same page, right? So for that technology to work well, it has to recognize that this is a motorcycle and not something else. It has to recognize. So there has to be a back and forth between the cars and the smaller vehicles and the motorcycles. And until that happens, are they really looking for the motorcycle to stop, or are they looking for cars? Or are they looking for people? Right. And of course, I'm on your page. I actually think humans, we're not great at not looking at our phones while driving.
It's pretty clear, right?
It's pretty clear. And I, honestly, I think that's going to get worse and worse. I don't think that's going to get better unless there's legislation or some sort of technology to ban that altogether, right? But people are going to do it. And so autopilot to me, like I said before, I think it's so good that I get really comfortable not having to look at the road.
Yes. But you've experienced that, and you, of course, are a motorcyclist. Mm-hmm. Like, when you go by a Tesla that you know is, I mean, I don't know, I feel like I see them enough, I can tell when they're on autopilot. Like, do you feel better or worse when you're about to drive? I'm just curious, like, your personal opinion.
No, definitely better, because I know that the car's looking. Even if the person's not looking, I know the car's at least seeing me. There's been a few incidents where it did recognize the motorcycle. That's a whole nother, right?
That's a problem.
That's the one thing that scares me, right?
If
it thinks I'm something else and it doesn't see me, then that's a whole different issue. But if it sees me like it sees other vehicles very consistently, then 100% is safer. And okay. I would definitely feel safer lane splitting that way.
So I think we've got to work on that. We've got to think about that, because I do think that's that's one very important future for all of us, is this idea that we love each other, we trust each other, we all need to be educated more, but are computers talking to computers sometimes better? Like, I mean, we all get on airplanes, right? I feel pretty good about that. That's a computer, right?
That's not me and you driving that.
But then, okay, now let's talk really quickly about lanes and like this idea of sharing the road. Clearly, your product is meant for the road. You're not supposed to touch the bike lane. There is more, there's more proposals here in California and around the world around lightweight electric vehicles and, you know, potentially allowing them in different types of designated lanes. This is often under 35 miles per hour. How do you feel about that in your product? Like, do you see your product actually living clearly it can go faster, but maybe it can be governed to go lower. Like, do you foresee a future where
you know, your products are in a designated lane that's designated for small electric vehicles, or are you always just designing for the normal road?
No, 100%. So, you know, from a business standpoint, we have to develop products that make sense now so that it's viable, right? So that's why it's focused on covering as much ground as possible right now. It's, it can be on the highway, it can be on this small urban streets. But the minute that starts, I mean, we're already starting to think about how to make urban specific vehicles, right? That are very optimized for urban environments. Because when it comes down to it, an urban motorcycle or scooter, whatever it is, will look drastically different than what a highway capable motorcycle is, right? Because it doesn't make sense if it doesn't, because it's kind of like, you can always go slower, but you shouldn't really be able to go faster, because if you do, it's not optimized. So if you are selling an urban only product that can go in a slow lane, like what you're talking about, it should be optimized for that. The bike lane should be optimized for the bike lane, right? There's no need for big motors that can go 70 miles an hour if you fit in the bike lane. And so I think every they should have their own space and be limited. But as in terms of a product, as a product develop, from a product development standpoint, we're always going to want to optimize for specific use cases, right? In the case of the Anthem, a little bit of highway, mostly urban, so small batteries, very lightweight, very easy to control, very easy to ride, but capable enough structurally to be on the highway going 75, 80 miles an hour.
Do you even see a future? Do you see a future where effectively the power you have, and include your batteries, getting more efficient or getting more powerful? So there's a future where, like, you can do a lot with one single mode that of a product that you have. Do you see a future where, like, you have these lanes in your geofence, so that, you know, like, basically, hey, this lane is designated for a lightweight electric vehicle, but then it's gonna, once you get out of that lane, the geofence comes off and you can open it up to sort of the road speeds? Like, do you think that's gonna happen, like, in our lifetime?
I think 100%. I think it can probably happen now. I mean, there is technology that are out now that will do geofencing for different speeds and different modes. The problem right now is that it's not law anywhere, right? There's nothing preventing the manufacturer from not doing that.
Yeah.
So right. The only way that's going to really work for everybody is if there's a standard rule to follow.
Yeah.
Beyond that, you're always going to have people riding wherever they want, right?
There's, of course.
There's fast bikes riding on beach lanes all the time. So
Totally. Yeah. Okay, so we got to wrap up here, Dong. You're going to be at Micromobility America. You're on kind of a tour, of course, around the country. I'd just be curious how the tour's been going, and you know, we're excited to see you at Micromobility America, and be curious what you plan to talk about there.
For sure, yeah. Tour's been going great. We just came back from Birmingham, in Alabama. People are probably wondering what we're doing out there, but it's the Barbie Museum is a destination that if you like two wheels, that's the place you have to go to. It's pretty much heaven on earth. It's amazing. But we showed up as the only EV manufacturer at the show. We were there with KTM, Yamaha, Royal Enfield, like these big motorcycle companies. BMW was their 100th year anniversary. So we were on the same demo area as they were, and the reception was incredible. Like, well, these are hardcore gasoline motorcyclists. They've grown up riding gas bikes, you know, they're young to old. Everyone, I think, almost immediately got what we're trying to do, right? From a messaging standpoint. So we had a ton of demos where a lot of these guys, this is their first time on EV anything, let alone EV motorcycle, right? So it was very exciting to see that specific part of the country really embracing EV, especially in a space where they don't think it makes sense, right? I mean, you're not going anywhere. So I think the use case kind of enable people to get that. So Barber was incredible. We're going to do a similar thing at Micromobility America. We're going to have a demo area where you can just get on, sign up, and ride the Anthem. We'll be talking about some of the retail sales strategies on smaller EV products. and then to have just an industry discussion with all the people there. So looking forward to it for sure.
Great. Yeah, no, I mean, you're going to be a big part of that. And I think it's really important that you're there. So for everyone coming to America, Microblading America, you're going to have a chance to ride the anthem. I highly encourage you to do so. For all the people that can't make it, Dong, like what's the best next step to try the vehicle, to buy the vehicle? What should they do?
We're going to be, so you can reach out with our sales team for local demos if you're in the California area. We're actually going to be doing more demo events that are geared specifically towards our customers and people who are interested. We'll also be at Electrify this weekend, actually. So
that's Miami?
You're interested in Miami. Yep. So that's always a big show for us because that's where all the EV heads go. And we're also doing demos there. So if you're interested and you're in Miami, you can show up there. And then more announcements will be coming as we go out and do more tours in the country.
Killer. Well, Dong, thanks again for the time. I'm excited to see you next week. And yeah, keep on riding.
Awesome. Appreciate it, James. Thank you.
Yep.